Welcome back to All Else Equal, a podcast connecting Notre Dame undergrads with faculty expertise.
It's been a while, hasn't it?
It certainly has. I've missed you. So who do we have on today?
Well, just like every other podcast on the planet, we thought it'd be topical to talk about the current crisis and war going on in Ukraine. Both Jason and I have received questions from students about economic sanctions, their impacts. We wanted to bring on an expert to tell us more. Today's guest is Zach Stangby, who's the Quinn and Jean, or perhaps Jean, Steppen Assistant Professor of Economics here at Notre Dame. And Zach specializes in international macro issues, particularly those related to sovereign debt issues, financial crises. He also teaches a popular writing-intensive course titled, not surprisingly, International Macro.
Well, it sounds like Zach is the perfect person to talk about the sanctions. Zach, thank you so much for being with us today. Forrest and I are eager to get back on the horse, so to speak, and so we're glad to talk with you. Forrest, what do you got for us today? What's the first question?
Well, maybe we just could start with some broad strokes about what's happening in the Russian macro economy. So within this week, so today's March the 4th, the Russian Central Bank raised interest rates to 20%. Their stock market, have been closed all week. And maybe we could just sort of start with, like, what's the purpose of these particular interventions? And then we'll move more afield.
Well, absolutely. Thanks again for having me on the podcast, both of you. So the point of these interventions on the Russian part, it's very common for central banks in emerging markets, this has been well known for a long time, to raise interest rates when things go south. That's, in one sense, the biggest difference between a developed economy and an emerging market is how their interest rates respond to a crisis. So when you see when COVID hit the U.S. or when 2008 hit the U.S., interest rates plummeted. All central banks in the U.S. and all over the world lowered their rates dramatically until they couldn't anymore. But what you see in a lot of emerging markets is when things go really bad for them, they raise rates. So Russia raised rates up to 20% just last week. They also did this in 2014. When we imposed a bunch of sanctions when they annexed Crimea. And they again raised rates, I think, from 7% to 17% back then. And why do they do that? The basic idea is they're trying to prop up the value of their currency. Them raising rates is essentially sucking up their own currency with the selling of foreign reserves. That's essentially what they're trying to do. Is their currency is falling. They're trying to prop it up. They're basically trying to prop up the value of their currency, and that's the method that they do that. And they typically do that by selling off foreign reserves that they have stored up.
Worried about inflation? Like, is that, like, when your value of your currency depreciates against mm-hmm. a basket of other currencies, is that the main concern? Is, like, you need now more of your own money to buy certain goods and services? And, or, like, what is that in-between mechanism? Like, what is, if I'm Russian, like, what am I feeling, right? Like, as your currency is devalued.
So I would say inflation, so Russia is nominally an inflation targeting central bank. That's, if you ask them what's their goal, they would say it's inflation targeting. They're not one that actively manages their exchange rate. But they and a lot of other emerging markets in the past 20 to 30 years, I would say it's a general trend in emerging markets that they've moved away from pegged systems to floating systems. So you look at Argentina, you look at Chile, you look at Mexico, you look at Thailand. A lot of these countries used to be pegged to the dollar. And they moved to a floating system in the past 20 years or so. But it's not a true floating system. And Russia falls into this category as well. Russia never had the peg to the dollar, but they're sometimes called dirty floats or managed floats, okay, where they're like, nominally, we're targeting inflation. But if the exchange rate gets out of hand, we're going to go ahead and deal with the exchange rate, right? And so they did this in 2014. It's not just Russia that's done this, too. Mm-hmm. Brazil's done this. A bunch of others have kind of intervened in foreign exchange markets, even though they're not technically supposed to. So they're on this sort of dirty float system. So are they worried about inflation? Probably. Inflation takes longer to move than the exchange rate. The exchange rate can move in seconds, right? And we've seen that. It can, in an hour, it can depreciate by, you know, 10% or more. Inflation at least takes at least a few months. It can be relatively quick, but it's not going to be as fast as the exchange rate. So when the central bankers meet at 2 in the morning to raise rates by 10%, they're not responding to inflation. Mm-hmm. They're responding to the exchange mm-hmm. rate. And that's primarily what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to prop up the value of their currency. They're also trying to raise returns in their economy to keep foreign investors from leaving and to keep mm-hmm. domestic investors from leaving as well. That's certainly part of it, is trying to keep money in Russia. And that's one of the reasons why the stock market gets closed down, Because one of the issues that you have in these crises like these is you get these fire sale dynamics. That everyone really panics. Everyone starts selling off Russian assets. And one of the... Oftentimes during a crisis like this, you'll see the government impose a wide variety of what we call capital controls, which are different measures to either limit the outflow or inflow of capital into the economy. And they can, they're hard to quantify exactly because they come in a lot of different forms. One of them is the form that Russia's been imposing, which is you can't sell off Russian stocks. Because if you can't sell off Russian stocks, it kind of breaks down some of the fire sale dynamics. Because pretty soon, you sell off stocks and that causes a dip in the price. And because you're worried about dipping the price, you're selling off more stocks, right? Sure. And you get this sort of self-fulfilling cycle that can really be quite damaging. And what Russia is clearly trying to do with measures like these are mitigate this sort of damage. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think they've done it yet. A pretty common thing that countries will do is put caps on ATM draws to try to keep people from, especially on dollars or something. So if you have dollars in a certain account, they'll say you can't take out more than $50 a day or $100 a day. Greece did this in 2012 with euros, for instance. There was a pretty hard cap on how many euros you could draw out because everyone was basically withdrawing their money out of Greek banks and putting them into German banks.
Oh, interesting.
Because they were worried that Greece was basically going to go under. And so Greece actually put a cap on that. And it's
so if you're Russian right now and you're going to, and I'm sure we've all seen the NPR stories and people lining up at McDonald's just to get access to cash. Like, if you're Russian, what are you doing with your rubles? Right. Well, you, because you're now, it feels
you're
like
frantically
you're really
trying to get dollars as fast as you can.
As you can, right? Yes. So that's what's happening. So, yeah. Like, where do you go, right? Like, what is the, what, without any sanctions, what is the traditional mechanism for, like, individuals to be able to get dollars?
Without sanctions in place,
yeah.
Normal interactions with foreign banks, which is part of what the sanctions are doing, right? So the U.S. has a pretty strong ability to level very painful sanctions, especially relative to other countries, and that is because the U.S. dollar serves as what's called the global reserve currency. So countries all over the world want dollars in ways they don't want other currencies, right? Countries will trade, non-U.S. countries will trade with each other in dollars most of the time. So China and Russia, for instance, during normal times, will often do their gas deals in dollars, right? And that's because there's it mitigates a lot of exchange rate risk on both sides because the dollar is seen as a very stable currency. It's also the fact that these big trade deals often have to be financed. It's not like these countries might do $100 million or $700 million trade deals in frequent succession. A lot of the times the firms that are initiating them don't always have that cash in hand. So trade finance is a whole thing in and of itself. But a big integral part of trade finance is the pledging of collateral. Mm. And almost always the collateral are some sort of U.S. treasuries or U.S. assets. Mm. And so because of that, it makes a lot of sense to do all the trade shares or all the quoting of the invoices in dollars and things like that. So I think there was a great paper by an economist at Boston College, Rosen Volchev. And he talked about the stability of the system. He notes that the dollar share of invoicing is 5 times the U.S. trade share of world trade.
Oh, wow.
And U.S. has the largest trade
share.
So dollar-valued invoicing, right, is 5 times the U.S. trade share. So that just means that not only are people, when we trade with people, we're quoting in dollars, but when, you know, Brazil and, you know, Chile are trading with each other, they're trading in dollars. And everybody borrows in dollars as well, because it's one of the cheapest ways to borrow. So there's a big demand for dollars for liquidity purposes. And this is especially true during crises. I mean, if you look back in 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, if you actually look on that particular day, this is a point that Barry Eichengreen at Berkeley has made. The dollar actually appreciated on that day, which you'd think would be a bit surprising. Mm-hmm. But the idea was everyone kind of understood that this was a collapse that was started in the U.S., but it was going to hit the whole world. And when it does hit the whole world, you want to be in the safe haven, which is the U.S., right? So the dollar actually rose upon news of Lehman collapsing. So there's a big – the dollar plays a strong and critical role in the global financial system. And so, you know, U.S. sanctions can hit pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And you're exactly right. You ask, well, where do they go if – to get dollars, the answer is they don't have a lot of options, right? And that's part of why the sanctions can be so biting. I mean, you can really see how heavily some of these sanctions can hit an emerging economy. A good example of this is Iran. If you look at Iran over the past 10 years, just look at their GDP growth. It goes from like negative 20% to like positive 20%. It just goes up and down and up and down. And it basically corresponds to when the U.S. imposes sanctions and when it releases sanctions, right? So there was a lot of sanctions imposed early in the 2010s. The Obama administration actually hit him with sanctions pretty hard originally in 2012, and then they tried to reach a deal, and they had the Iran nuclear deal around 2015, mm-hmm. and they went from like minus 15% growth to like plus 20% growth.
Wow.
And then they were high for a couple years, and then Trump killed that and reimposed sanctions, and they went right back down. Now, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, if you were going to identify
yeah.
like a particular sanction that bit the most, mm-hmm. like say in the Iranian case, like what is it?
In the Iranian case, I think it was no doubt. My understanding of it, I don't know all the specifics of that, but they actually pretty specifically targeted their oil exports, which is not something we've been doing in Russia recently, by the way, which that's one key difference between something that we did with, say, Iran or previous sanctions and how we've been treating Russia in this case. But Iran, like Russia, is a big oil exporter and relies very heavily on that. So it's that, and it's also dollar financing and access to dollars abroad. Yeah.
So to take a step back, Russian Central Bank is doing a couple things to help keep their currency from depreciating. They're raising interest rates, which keeps, you know, which raises the return on Russian assets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They are selling foreign reserves.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that they're doing to kind of actively manage their exchange rate right now?
Those are really the two tools they have at their disposal. Okay. I mean, a central bank is limited in what it can do. I mean, what a central bank basically does is it prints money, and it can use that money to buy one of two things. It can either buy domestic assets, or it can buy foreign reserves, right?
Okay.
And so when it's trying desperately to prop up the value of the currency, it's either selling off foreign reserves or selling off domestic assets. And the former is targeted explicitly at the exchange rate, and the latter is targeted explicitly, typically, at the nominal interest rate, although there's definitely some bleed over across the two, sort of depending on the degree of market frictions. But they're doing that in a pretty serious way. And that's explicitly what the Biden administration is trying to prevent. I mean, when they say they're sanctioning the Russian Central Bank, they know that this is going to be the response of the Russian Central Bank. And so they're trying to prevent their ability to cut off the devaluation.
Okay, but, that's a good segue to then sort of thinking about what these specific Russian economic sanctions are and kind of how they've played out so far.
Yeah. So my understanding from these different Russian sanctions is we start off by... So the first wave of sanctions in most cases, and kind of the same here, they'll freeze assets abroad for key players in the Russian economy. So they'll freeze some of Putin's assets abroad. So if Putin has, assets and accounts in the U.S. or the U.K. or something, they're frozen, he doesn't have access to them. And that's true for, like, at least 30-plus members of his cabinet. And you can go find a list of kind of who all has their assets frozen. That usually doesn't do very much because they sort of anticipate that you're going to do this sort of thing and they're not necessarily that reliant. But it's usually step number one. The other thing that they have done is they sort of did this in stages. That's usually the first stage. And to be honest, it probably wouldn't have gone much farther than that had things not played out the way they did. It's kind of interesting because the sanctions kind of come as a story with the rest of the invasion in some sense. I think that what Putin thought was going to happen was what happened back in 2014, where he basically just walked into Crimea, took it, and nobody put up a fight. It was basically a bloodless land grab. And we imposed some sanctions of this kind. We restricted to some degree their ability to have access to foreign banks. But I don't believe we cut off their central bank's access back then. And I think that Putin sort of thought that was going to be the case. And to be honest, it might have been the case had the Ukrainians not put up such a hard fight. Right? I think that's what he didn't really anticipate. I don't think anyone really anticipated it that much, is that they started to fight. And they didn't just walk in and take it. They're now engaged in a big battle. And one of the things that I think, seeing the sort of stories of heroism coming out of Ukraine, I think galvanized a lot of Western countries to do mm-hmm. more than they probably would have. I mean, I think if Putin had just walked in, taken the whole of Ukraine like he took Crimea, I think we probably would have imposed these minor sanctions like we did in 2014, not much more. I think the fact that there was sort of a revolutionary resistance fighting this whole thing was what galvanized the rest of the world to impose things like SWIFT. They cut them out of, and this was really initiated by the Europeans, actually, who've taken a lot more initiative over the past few days than I think anyone thought that they would. And what SWIFT actually is it's not itself a bank, right? SWIFT is a communication system. It's almost like a social network. It's almost like Facebook or something, right? It's like how banks talk to each other on their social media in some sense. But the thing is it's a messaging system. Is all it is. Its benefits are, it's the biggest network around, right? So it's like, well, why is Swift important? It's like, well, why do you use Facebook instead of MySpace? It's like, because everyone else is on Facebook, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. There's like a strong network, externality effects, yeah. that Swift has going on. And it's also highly secure. Security is really important in these international transactions. It's very hard to hack it because, you know, if you're transferring money from one person to another in your own country and there's some sort of fraud, you could potentially take that person to court or take that bank to court to litigate that. Mm-hmm. But if you have fraud on an international level, you can't usually take that other person sure. to court. They're yeah. in a different country. There's no legal jurisdiction that's overseeing both of you. So, you know, security is really important. And Swift has really good security. So because it's so big and so secure, that's basically how banks communicate with each other. So it's a messaging system is effectively what it is. So it doesn't actually transfer any funds. But typically it's a prerequisite for the transfer of any funds, right? So if I'm going to transfer funds from a bank in Russia to a bank in Germany, there's going to need to be a Swift message that happens before the actual funds get transferred. And then they get transferred through some other mechanism, through a clearinghouse or through some sort of bank-to-bank networks that they themselves have established. But that's essentially what it is. So when you cut them off from Swift, you're sort of cutting them off the knees from... It's like being...
Who is that?
It's like being canceled.
Okay. Right? Who is being canceled here?
So Swift is a private entity, technically, that was originally founded by financial institutions in the early 70s. There were only six or seven initially, and it really grew. It's owned by its members. So Swift is actually owned by the financial institutions, and they all contribute to it. But okay. it's heavily regulated by mm-hmm. governments. And it's regulated in particular by the G10 central banks. So basically, it's basically run by the ECB and the Fed, essentially. And this not run by it, but it's regulated by that. If the Fed and the ECB come together and they say, we're going to restrict these banks from accessing Swift, they have the regulatory authority to do that.
And they're now cutting Russian private banks from these messages.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So it's Russian banks that are canceled.
Yes. These, again, it's like getting canceled from YouTube or Facebook. Yeah. I mean, you might still have access to MySpace or Parler, but it's not, right? It's not going to have the same sort of
impact. I don't get the same dopamine hit that's when right. someone likes my Parler message.
That's exactly it, right? So there are other means to send messages. There are means to get across if you don't use Swift. And that's why Swift itself, it's not actually that damaging. I think it's more about the message sending, that we're taking this very seriously.
Really?
What's more damaging, I think, is what the U.S. is doing to the Central Bank of Russia.
Saying, oh, interesting.
Right? Because you could potentially say, all right, you can't use SWIFT, but maybe I'm going to use some other one. There's a couple of them. I can't remember the other ones. There's,
yeah.
Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System. China runs its own version of this. So you could say, well, look, I'm still going to go to J.P. Morgan using some different system. And
I didn't
sell
know
stuff.
This. This is interesting.
Without using Swift. And it's not going to be as easy. It might take a little bit longer, but you can still do it. But when yeah. they come in and say, no, JP Morgan's not allowed to interact with you. They're not allowed to buy your bonds. You're not allowed to buy their foreign reserves when mm-hmm. they're trying to sell these on the foreign market. So there's a whole...
That's the sanctions on the central bank.
Yes, that's a sanction on the central bank. But it's also many of the sanctions on private banks and large private companies as well. So if you look at what they actually sanctioned, they sanctioned... The largest bank, I wouldn't be able to read it even if I had it, but they basically sanctioned them off, and they have 25 subsidiaries in Russia. They account for 1/3 of Russia's financial system, and they're completely cut off, so they can't access dollars abroad. U.S. banks can't interact with them. European banks can't interact with them. That is a lot more damaging than SWIFT, mm-hmm. because that is you lose access to this market no matter what messaging system you're using. And there's a whole bunch of others. They list at least 20 or 30 different Russian banks. But also they list critical companies that are not allowed to do this because Russia is a quasi-socialistic economy, right? It's technically not socialist in the way that something like North Korea or maybe Venezuela is explicitly socialist, but it's pretty obvious that, you know, when Putin wants something, he goes to the gas companies and they give it to him, mm-hmm. right? And one of the things that they've done very often in the past is they'll have the gas companies raise money for them mm-hmm. abroad. And basically funnel that into the Russian treasuries. So they actually placed sanctions on the Gazprom, which is one of the large Russian oil producers, and many others. They had a telecommunication system, Rostelecom, Russian Railways, a whole bunch of others, which these companies could go raise money potentially abroad and then try to bring it back to Russia outside of the financial system, right. sort of. Yeah. And so there's sanctions on those as well to try to prevent that. So they really are trying to sanction as much as they possibly can. The one thing that's absent from all that, though, the most notable thing that's absent is the energy sector. In fact, the banks that they specifically did not cut out of SWIFT are like the two or three banks that do most of the manage most of the oil exports to the EU and to the US as well, because both the EU and the US buy a lot of Russian gas. So that is they're trying to inflict as much damage as possible while not touching the oil and energy sector.
A very good segue into a question Forrest and I were talking about is like, what is potentially the U.S. impacts from doing some of these things?
Yeah.
You know, if it comes to, I, you know, not to speculate, but if it comes to us actually shutting down those energy bank interactions, like, what does that do for us, you know, as an economy, maybe in the short run versus the long run?
Yeah, it basically is going to mean higher energy prices if we did that. And that's something that, I mean, I think there's a reason why Putin chose this moment too, in that energy prices are pretty high, right? That's a couple things. That's coming out of COVID. There's more demand than there was. So gas prices have been rising kind of at the trough of COVID. Energy prices were all the way down to like $25 a barrel, something like that. It was very, very low. And it's up past $100 now. And it's continuing to rise largely because of the conflict. But even by the time the conflict started, energy was up to, say, $100 a barrel. Mm-hmm. That's another big difference between now and 2014. When he went to annex Crimea in 2014, he was actually in a fairly weak position. Energy this was basically the bottom of energy prices back in the 2010s. Sure. I don't know if you remember this, but this is basically the U.S. shale and fracking revolution kind of took off.
Yeah.
And energy and oil kind of went from like $100 a barrel in like 2011, 2012, and it dropped to like 30 by 2014, 2015. And this crushed the Russian economy. Russia had a big crisis back then, similar to now. It seems worse now than it was back then, but I mean, still early to kind of see everything, but it was pretty bad. It was also bad for a lot of other countries. This was really what did Venezuela in. Venezuela never recovered from this. Countries like Saudi Arabia issued bonds for the first time ever. In 2016, because they've always had so much oil wealth, they've never actually had to borrow abroad.
That is.
Yeah, but in 2016, they issued their first ever Saudi Arabia royal oil bond. And so it hit a lot of countries. I mean, this was a big shock. Today, it's not like that. So Russia was in a relatively weak position back then, because energy was very, very cheap, and that's basically what they provide, right? That's essentially what they are, is they're a gas station with nuclear weapons, as some people have put it, right? But this is effectively how their economy runs. I mean, it's something like 40% of their federal budget comes straight from oil, and that's probably and that's from oil exports, and that's probably an underestimation. It's more than 60% of their exports, because you know whatever they get from oil is going to feed through to the rest of the economy with kind of multiplier effects. When the energy sector goes down, they really go down in a pretty significant way. And the fact that energy prices are so high right now is really benefiting them. It's giving them a lot of leverage. And they're high for a variety of reasons. One is coming back out of the pandemic. The other has been like this is a consequence of a lot of environmental policy that's been pursued. I mean, Germany, for instance, has invested a lot in renewable and sustainable technologies. But they're not there yet, right? So how are they powering their people while they're trying to make solar batteries better? Well, they're basically just importing a bunch of Russian oil, right? And this is partly a consequence of that. I mean, and it's put us in a weaker bargaining position too. The fact that, you know, we killed the Keystone 2 pipeline last year has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, even us as the U.S., we import something like 600,000 barrels of oil from Russia a day. And the more energy independent you are, you know, the stronger you're going to be when you come to this negotiation table. I mean, if Putin was not in a position of such relative strength, I don't think he would have tried to attempt something like this. But that plays into it as well. And it's also, you can see that they're trying to strategically impose the sanctions so as to avoid the energy sector, because they do know that that's where their own economies are going to suffer from the most. Gas prices will get up to, you know, potentially $4, $5, $6 a gallon if they were to impose that, and that's going to be so unpopular for them, that they might not be willing to do that. And Putin is, to some extent, counting on that. Right?
Oh, that's really interesting, especially with midterm elections coming up. Right, I'm sure that's something that you don't want
absolutely.
To see happen.
Absolutely, and the White House has said this openly. Yeah. Openly, she's. Right. I mean, Jen Psaki in the press briefings have said, you know, we're imposing sanctions as much as we can while trying to shield the American people. And the way they're basically doing that is trying to do all possible sanctions except oil and energy.
Yeah.
And even that, they can only do it partially. I mean, you may have noticed gas prices rise pretty dramatically over the last week. I mean, just a couple weeks ago, I think I went to fill up my tank and it was like $3.20 a gallon, and now it's almost $4 a gallon. Yeah. And that's just and that's just because all this is making oil prices rise. And even if there's not explicit sanctions on the energy sector, you know, gas and transportation costs are still gonna go up. But they would go up by a lot more if there were explicit sanctions on the energy sector.
So could we see coming back to the United States in the short run? We know that Jerome Powell is going to be meeting with the Fed board here and Open Market Committee to make some determinations about federal funds rates. Like, does this change the calculus of what they're doing a little bit, you think?
Probably. I haven't thought that much about it, about that aspect of it, to be honest. But if I were to take a guess, I mean, the Fed has a dual mandate. It's supposed to keep prices stable, and it's supposed to minimize unemployment, right? And it's been signaling for the past few months that it's pretty clear that it wants to start raising rates. It's seeing more danger coming from the inflation side of things than it's seeing coming from the unemployment side of things. Higher energy prices, if I were to take a guess, are probably going to have a much bigger impact on inflation than unemployment.
Right.
So I would guess that it wouldn't deter them. If anything, it would probably... Yeah. I mean, this is kind of what we saw in the 70s. I mean, the 70s, you saw a lot of inflation, and there was sort of two sources for it. One was there was a lot of spending that the government was doing, and the Fed wasn't really wrangling it. And this was things like the Great Society programs that were initiated in the 1960s. But it was also the Vietnam War, kind of these two... so much spending happened in the kind of mid-60s and into the early 70s that the U.S. just left the gold standard entirely. They were on the Bretton Woods gold standard, and at a certain point, Nixon just said, screw it, we're leaving.
We need more money.
Because our currency's too hard, and we're going to devalue so we can spend more, essentially. And the Fed had kind of a tepid response to that. So if you look at the Fed's response back then, between about 1975 and 1980, the Fed was raising rates, but they were doing it pretty slowly. I think it went from like 3 or 4% up to like 7% between 1975 and 1980. So it was kind of slow and incremental, and the inflation was getting worse the whole time. And then in 1979, Paul Volcker was nominated chair of the Fed, and he basically said, we have enough of this. So within, I think, 3 or 4 months, he raised rates by 10%. So from like 7% to 10%. And that caused a recession in 1980 and 1981. But it killed the inflation. It was successful in doing that. And we haven't seen inflation again since. I mean, that sort of the reputation that the Fed has for... The reputation that the Fed established in doing that led to decades of, you know, relatively tranquil monetary policy and relatively tranquil. I mean, there's this period known as the Great Moderation between about 1980 and about 2007, where boom-bust cycles in the U.S. were pretty darn smooth. There wasn't a lot of volatility. There wasn't these big booms and recessions. And a lot of people attributed that to good monetary policy that was largely started by Volcker. So, I mean, the question now, I think, is is the Fed going to respond like Paul Volcker did? Right. I don't actually know. I'd like to think that they would, but I'm not actually sure. I mean, part of the reason why we could do something like quadruple the size of the Fed balance sheet in 2008, because back in 2008, there was a lot of concern that all the money printing the Fed was doing, and they were doing a lot of money printing. Again, they went from having a $1 trillion balance sheet to a $4 trillion balance sheet. And basically, they quadrupled the money supply. There was a lot of concern that was going to cause inflation. And rightfully so. There were a lot of people screaming, this is a terrible idea. This is going to cause inflation. And the funny thing was, it didn't. It didn't cause inflation. And there were sort of many reasons for that. But one of the big reasons is that they sort of believed that if there were ever real price pressures on the economy, that the Fed would respond instantly, just like they did back in 1980, right? And so as long as people believed that the Fed would respond that strongly, The Fed doesn't actually have to do it, right? It's, it's like your reputation buys you something, right? Yeah. It's like, trust me, I've got this. You know, if things get out of hand, I'll take care of it. That's sort of the, and people sort of believe that, I think. And what the recent inflation, I think, in the U.S. is sort of showing is that people are starting to weaken in that expectation. Mm-hmm. They're maybe not buying that the Fed is the same kind of Fed that we saw back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're right. I don't know. I mean, even now, they're Powell this last week talked about rate rises, and they're talking about, you know, 25 basis points, maybe 50 basis points. It's like, yeah, rates are lower now than they used to be, but, I mean, Volcker raised it by 10%, by 1,000 basis points in, like, a few months, right? So if you really want to stop this, you might need a much more drastic response than that, right? And maybe the economy now is different than it was in 1980, but I'm a little skeptical that a 25 basis point increase is going to do anything to stop the current pressures on prices.
The tip spread for today is 2.69%. So the difference between the Treasury inflation protected 10-year bond and the non-inflation protected one is market participants are betting on 2.69% inflation over that run.
10 years.
I don't know. Like, we'll see.
I'm glad we wrapped up or we finished with thinking about some of the implications of the United States and what's happening there. Forrest, you have any questions?
I have tons of questions, but this is like probably like a natural.
We can keep talking as long as you want, or we can cut it off. I'll sit here and I'll talk for hours about this stuff. Don't tempt me, or I'll do it.
We didn't prepare a lightning round, but we usually ask a bunch of lightning round questions.
Impromptu lightning round.
We're
out of practice. It's been
So I'm going to be really bad.
And Zach didn't realize he was getting into this. All right, Zach, favorite place on campus.
Favorite place on campus. I like the new student center quite a bit.
Least favorite place on campus.
Least favorite place on campus. Probably Flanner Hall, where my office used to be.
Wow.
It's not the friendliest building.
Yeah. Favorite Fed chair?
Favorite Fed chair? I don't know. Probably Paul Volcker, to be honest. I think he was... I mean, Ben Bernanke did a pretty excellent job as well. But
I would
Volcker or Bernanke.
Big hug from Paul Volcker. Just a gigantic man enveloping me in his arms.
What's your least favorite thing about Eric Sims?
I don't have a least favorite thing about Eric Sims. Eric Sims is a perfect human being.
That's right. Actually, what more could you ask for? Both of us.
That's it. Yeah. Eric Sims is perfect. That's right. We have nothing negative.
And make sure he listens to this interview. Right?
You know what? So I will say, Eric did say that he would take macro musings over us. Which is like a true statement, but he shouldn't have said it on our podcast.
It costs us like 5 listeners. So
that's like, that's the only people left are our parents.
That's right. Hi, Mom. All right. So, Zach, thank you so much for contributing. We really appreciate the conversation. I learned, obviously, a ton that I didn't know before. And so I'm glad that you were the first guest back on after our long hiatus. So thank you so much.
Happy to do it. Thanks again, gentlemen.
That was so good. Wow. It's great to be back, but Zach's such a great guest. I thought Zach's discussions about Swift and the Swift payment workaround were incredibly interesting. Maybe we still have some plays left in the global sanction playbook.
Yeah, I always found international macro to be like a difficult thing to understand intuitively, and I thought Zach did a great job of laying it out in simple terms. Also, for the lost episodes on the 7 Deadly Sins, if you're an All Else Equal fan, you might know what we're talking about. Stay tuned. At some point, we're going to go back and bring on the legendary John Ivory Winston III to talk with us about Jim Otteson's book.
Yeah. Well, we'll link Zach's website and also keep listeners in the loop when Zach starts his own podcast/vlog. Maybe we'll see a goat in there.
There's going to be maybe goats.
The Viking Economist. For the Notre Dame students listening, please have a safe break wherever you are at. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of the All Else Equal podcast. As always, if you have any questions, please feel free to email allelseequalpodcast@gmail.com.